May it please the court, counsel. My name is Patrick Mulligan, registration number 16981 on behalf of Mr. Schneider. Mr. Schneider is in the Department of Corrections. A number of his family members are here in attendance. We raised a number of issues in the briefing before this court. We feel strongly about all of them, but given time constraints, we're going to try to focus on two, and because one issue dovetails with another, we might even say three. But that's our hope. I would like to reserve some time for rebuttal, and I'll be mindful of the timer that the court has alerted me to. On behalf of Mr. Schneider, I'd like to begin today with a hypothetical that we believe applies with great force to the scenario in this case involving Mr. Schneider and the complaining witness, KB. I want to move from that to a second hypothetical and then to the actual facts as presented at trial.
The first and just as a cautionary note, these arguments are available on the internet, so do be careful to use the initials, please.
Understood, Judge. Thank you, and I'll do that. Hypothetical number one. Had the evidence in this case been as follows, at the party preceding the sexual encounter, KB told numerous people in attendance at the party that she wished to have sexual relations with Mr. Schneider, that she was attracted to Mr. Schneider, that she was intent upon having some sort of sexual relations with Mr. Schneider. No one in the state of Colorado, to my knowledge, no one in any U.S. jurisprudence that I've been able to find would object to the admission of that evidence as relevant and admissible evidence. Now, I grant that's a hypothetical, but I want to move from that hypothetical to one step further down the road. Had the alleged victim in this case, KB, told numerous people in attendance at the party that she was intent upon having sexual relations with someone that night, that it was her goal to have sexual relations with someone that night, and that she was intent upon having sexual relations with someone that night. And then, later that night, a sexual encounter with Mr. Schneider ensued, and an allegation of sexual assault ensued therefrom. It is our position that that evidence would have been admissible and exempt from calculation or from exclusion, rather, under the rape shield statute. In each of the hypotheticals presented, the evidence, in our view, would have been admissible as res gestae and admissible as state of mind evidence of the complaining witness, evidence of potential motive on the part of the complaining witness to later assert that a sexual assault had occurred, and perhaps most importantly, fundamental relevant defense evidence that the defendant had a right to present. As support for that proposition, and I'm glad that I cited it in the opening brief, I candidly wish I had spent more time on this case because it is so directly analogous in our view. One of the cases that we cited at page 19 of the opening brief is a case called Villafranco v. State from the state of Georgia. In that case, there was a ruling pre-trial that a complaining witness's statements in the hours leading up to the sexual encounter with the defendant, statements including words to the effect that she, and this is from the case, this is again from the Villafranco case, that she, quote, wanted to get some nookie, end quote. Statements to the effect that she was intent upon engaging in some sort of sexual relations. Those statements were ruled inadmissible by the trial court. The defendant was convicted and obviously pursued his appeal. And on appeal, the appellate court said no. These statements are admissible as relevant defense evidence. They're not the same thing as prior sexual conduct on the part of the complaining witness. The defendant's conviction in Villafranco was, as I noted, I think in the opening brief, reversed. In our view, the case here presents the same thing. The evidence sought to be admitted was evidence from the same night evidence from just hours and perhaps even minutes preceding the sexual encounter with the defendant, and evidence that did not in any way assert any kind of prior sexual history on the part of the complaining witness, KB. Instead, the evidence that KB had engaged in provocative and flirtatious behavior, the evidence of her conduct was admissible as relevant defense evidence. And in our view, the conduct itself had a testimonial quality to it. That is, it reflected the state of mind of the complaining witness from the same night as the sexual encounter, the state of mind of the complaining witness just hours or perhaps even minutes before the sexual encounter with Mr. Schneider.
Mr. Mulligan.
Yes, sir.
Thank you for your presentation, and I understand where you're coming from, but I want to ask you a question about the import of this testimony. Not mentioned in the briefs, or really argued by the state or yourself, is the fact that Mr. Schneider himself testified at trial to this provocative conduct that you're describing, which I think they describe as exercises on the yoga ball that was revealing her body.
Right.
Not only did Mr. Schneider testify about it, but Mr., I believe his name is Nichols, the host of the party, also testified about the provocative conduct. So the three witnesses who are not permitted to testify would have testified to apparently exactly the same thing. It appears to me from the record, the evidence came in, was in front of the jury, and was available to be argued anyway. So why, if anything, is the exclusion of these three witnesses testimony not simply cumulative testimony, therefore harmless error?
Oh, in our view, it's far from harmless, and for this reason, Judge. Mr. Schneider's testimony, and I wasn't there, of course, we're operating from a cold record, but Mr. Schneider's testimony could obviously have been discounted by the jury as motivated, since he was, in fact, the defendant who faced potentially a life sentence if convicted. When a defendant has, frankly, having done defense work for a long time, anytime a defendant has any corroborating witnesses who can corroborate his account and were there and could have bolstered, in effect, Mr. Schneider's account of the actions and conduct preceding the sexual encounter, we believe that's absolutely critical.
But Mr. Nichols did testify to that fact, and he did, if you want to put it the way, bolster the evidence. He testified exactly the same kind of conduct that the three people would have testified to had they been permitted to testify.
Exactly.
Actually, Mr. Nichols testified even more.
Well,
and if you've read the record, you know that Mr. Nichols testified that outside the presence of the defendant, and in fact not at the party, the victim pulled up her shirt and pressed her body against him.
I did see that, Judge.
And so to argue that she was engaged in provocative conduct was certainly available to the defendant.
It was, some of it. And some of it was excluded, in our view, with an erroneous analysis by the trial court that it was A, sexual conduct, and B, not relevant. So I grant, Judge, that some of this evidence was admitted in the form of Mr. Schneider's testimony and Mr. Nichols. But the other witnesses cited in the briefs had additional observations, additional corroboration, and it's difficult, at least for me, to call exclusion of that kind of relevant, in our view, compelling defense evidence harmless, especially whereas here, KB's testimony at trial was she didn't recall, she didn't want to, quote, do this to this poor guy, end quote. She didn't recall any part of the sexual encounter. Given that evidence, that testimonial evidence by KB at trial, I don't think we can say that exclusion of this evidence was harmless, in our view.
What specifically would any of these three witnesses have said that is more indicative of provocative comment, provocative conduct, than what came in through MN, through Nichols or the defendant's testimony?
I think the court's question is a good one, because I don't think it would have been more provocative, but I think it would have been more evidence. And when you're dealing with a case where, as we believe here, the evidence was at best tenuous, especially given Katie's trial testimony, exclusion of that evidence that we think would have been bolstering, corroborating, in our view, can't be viewed as harmless.
Do you agree we're reviewing for, we would review for harmless error, not constitutional harmless error?
I don't agree that I actually think it would be reviewed for constitutional harmless error, because I think it's a violation of Mr. Schneider's fundamental constitutional right to present the defense evidence.
Even though some similar evidence was admitted, it's still constitutional error?
In our view, it is. Yes, if it's relevant, admissible defense evidence, and it was excluded erroneously, in our view, that's a violation of his fundamental constitutional right.
Now, if the timer on the podium is working, you have 5 minutes left, more or less.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. And I did want to at least reference two other issues that connect with one another, and I'll be brief because I want to save some time for rebuttal. We argued that one of the two sexual assault convictions in this case was not supported by sufficient evidence, and we argued in argument six that the two sexual assault convictions merge. Those are different arguments, but they are similar in this regard. The allegation that and the conviction for Mr. Schneider that he engaged in evidence that overcame the will, I'm sorry, in conduct that overcame the will of the complaining witness is not supported by any evidence. There was no evidence from Katie's testimony at trial that she ever asserted her will, and no evidence that Mr. Schneider ever overcame it.
But it wasn't the tape that was played to the jury evidence of both facts?
I don't think so, Judge. I think the tape that was played to the jury would supply, if deemed credible, which we have some difficulty with, obviously, from the defense side, would supply sufficient evidence to convict on the allegation that Mr. Schneider, the other sexual assault allegation, that essentially Mr. Schneider took advantage of a helpless witness incapable of appraising her conduct. But that's different, and the case that we cited in support of our insufficiency argument, People versus Keene, is very much on point here. Evidence that the defendant allegedly took advantage, if you will, of a victim who was unable to apprise the nature of her conduct is not the same thing as evidence that he overcame her will. And we believe, as part of our separate argument, that if the court rules somehow that that evidence is sufficient, our separate argument in argument number six, that these convictions have to merge, is a similar but different argument. In support of that argument, we say People versus Garcia.
What do you do with the tape? The tape, she said, I came to, I woke up, something to that effect, and I said, stop, stop. She's been testified with the tape, recorded that statement. Isn't that indicative of overcoming your will? You didn't stop.
I actually, Judge, my recollection of the record, and I do recall the tape, is that at that time that she's yelling, stop, stop, she wrests herself free and bolts out of the room, which is factually similar to the People versus Keene case that we cited in our sufficiency argument. In that case, the alleged victim is able to wrest free from the defendant, and the conviction for sexual assault with the actual application of physical force was deemed to not be sustained by sufficient evidence. The allegation that he would have taken, or that he allegedly took advantage of the hapless and helpless victim who was unable to apprise her conduct, I think is consistent with the statements made in the tape. It's candidly not particularly consistent with KB's trial testimony, which we spent some time on in the briefs. But in our view, these two convictions can't stand together, and even if they do, as we try to articulate in argument six, pursuant to People versus Garcia, and a number of other cases, there is no separation in time, no separation in location, no volitional departure, the appellate court's words, that would separate two separate sexual assaults in this case. And as the court indicated in the Garcia case, if we are unable with even appellate review to discern a separation in time, a separation in location, or some volitional departure between two acts, then the acts must merge, or the convictions for the acts must merge. And it would be our position that they must. We'd like to save what limited time I have left for rebuttal.
You can run the podium up if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor.
You may proceed.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Michael McMaster, registration number 42368, on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. I'll address the two issues presented by the defendant here, although if the court has any questions relating to the other issues that were briefed, obviously feel free to ask. Beginning with the rape shield statute as presented by the defendant, Judge Richmond is correct that the briefing was wanting in some of the clarity with respect to which witnesses were excluded, which witnesses were included, and what their testimony would be. As a matter, in an effort to provide some of that clarity, both the defendant and Mr. Nichols testified as to the behavior of the victim at the party immediately preceding the assault. The three witnesses which were excluded, their testimony was about the victim's behavior at a different party, at a barbecue earlier in the day. The defendant wasn't present at that party.
Does that matter? Is this consent about the state of mind of the defendant, or is consent about the state of mind of the victim?
No, I think it matters when we're looking at whether or not the trial court abused its discretion. Here, it ruled as to what was more relevant, what was less relevant. The testimony of those three individuals, which was excluded, had very minimal probative value as to whether or not the victim consented, but it had substantial prejudice, especially when viewed through the lens of the rape shield statute, because that's exactly the type of behavior that the rape shield statute is intended to exclude, that type of embarrassing fishing expedition.
Now, I'm actually a little confused about what you're saying, because I thought at least one of those three witnesses was testifying about her conduct on that yoga ball. At least one of them I thought was testifying about she was showing off her body by bouncing on the yoga ball, which was at the party at Nichols' house, not at the barbecue, if I understand the facts were. At least one of them.
Correct. That's Mr. Charmley, the individual, I believe. Charmley.
Yes.
And Mr. Nichols, the owner of the apartment and defense's own witness, he indicated that Mr. Charmley was not at the party. So that was a.
That would have been a credibility determination for the jury. That's really not a rape shield.
That's true. During the motions hearing, there was a brief discussion about that. But I think it provides us a good segue to pivot, I think, to the easy way for this court to rule, which is that in making that ruling, the trial court essentially ruled in the alternative that the evidence wasn't admissible pursuant to 403. It had a very minimal probative value, but substantial prejudicial effect. And that's independent of the rape shield, of an analysis under the rape shield statute. Now,
403 of the rules, not 403 of the statute.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Why isn't it race justa?
Of the three individuals we're talking about here?
Yeah, this is all in the space of less than 12 hours, more or less. Probably less than six.
You're correct that it's a number of hours preceding the individual, or preceding the attack. It's at a different location when the defendant was not present. The only way in which it is relevant is to suggest, and this is the antiquated idea that the rape shield statute was intended to rebut, that an individual who is flirtatious or even promiscuous can't be raped by someone. You know, it's along the same lines or the same analysis that a prostitute can't be raped. That's precisely the legislative purpose of the rape shield statute. That is. And I think I direct the court's attention to the Supreme Court's discussion in KN. It provides a very nice discussion of what, you know, the prevailing thought was prior to the rape shield statute. And it was viewed as, you know, whether or not someone consented to sex with a different individual at a different time made it more likely that she would have consented to sex with the defendant.
But isn't the key of that a different time? I mean, I agree if the victim, alleged victim here, engaged in provocative behavior 6 months ago, it wouldn't come in, but we're talking 6 hours.
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would, I don't think that makes a difference. An individual can be flirtatious. She could be even flirtatious with the defendant, but that doesn't provide the defendant with carte blanche. If she doesn't consent to sex, then it is sexual assault, regardless of whether or not she was flirtatious before. Now,
couldn't a reasonable juror infer consent from immediately prior for flirtatious conduct? I mean, in flirtatious is here somewhat of an understatement, but I'm not going to go into the details. Could a reasonable juror draw that conclusion?
In this case, under these facts, no, Your Honor, because that flirtatious behavior, and we're speaking only about the three individuals who were testifying about a barbecue where the defendant wasn't present. Her behavior, the defendant was not aware of her behavior.
What difference does that make? The jury was instructed on consent, was it not?
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so the jury is going to decide whether or not the victim consented. They're not going to decide whether the defendant may have been mistaken as to her attitude toward the sexual conduct.
That's correct.
Okay, so what difference does it make whether the flirtatious conduct was in his presence? I agree it'd be different if it was directed at him, but you know, there's, I don't know how many people are at this party. What difference does it make whether he happens to be present?
Well, I suggest that, I mean, the primary reason, whether or not they could make that inference, is I don't think it is the appropriate question. The appropriate question is, would that then be permissible under the Rape Shield statute? And it would not be, because as a policy matter, the legislature has decided that's the exact type of inference we don't want jurors to be making. We don't want jurors to believe that a prostitute can't be raped.
Well, you suggested to Judge Richman that the lower court could be upheld on an alternative 403 analysis. If we look at it only as a 403 question, then isn't the sole inquiry whether a reasonable juror could consider that her flirtatious conduct was probative of her subsequent alleged consent?
Your Honor, I apologize if I misunderstood your question.
Okay.
If we're solely under a 401, 403 analysis, then we're weighing against the potential prejudicial effect. And this court's decision in Kyle, in making a 403 analysis, still views it through the lens of the Rape Shield statute. It blurs it a little bit insofar as it allows the Rape Shield statute to inform the court the type of prejudice that a potential witness or victim would experience. And here, the trial court was correct in ruling that whatever minimal probative value it may have, insofar as the jury may infer consent or not, was outweighed by the prejudicial effect of, you know, this type of this fishing expedition into the victim's sexual behavior, the behavior of the party. This is the type of embarrassing information that the Rape Shield statute was specifically designed to keep out. Likewise, under 403, it's that prejudicial effect that outweighs the very minimal probative value when we're talking about those three individuals.
Where is the humiliation and the prejudice insofar as, at least according to these four witnesses, the victim made a public display in the presence of however many people were at this party? I mean, it seems to me that's qualitatively different from some private sexual liaison that the victim may have had in the past. And this is essentially public behavior.
It is public behavior of an intoxicated 16-year-old girl. I believe that unquestionably can be embarrassing behavior. And I think in reviewing the record, it's clear that this is the type of behavior that would be embarrassing to all of the most callous individuals.
Is there any authority in the state that supports your proposition that provocative conduct is not relevant, is not probative of consent? Putting it outside the Rape Shield context, just as a matter of relevancy, or materiality, has there anything published in this state? Says that? I'm not aware of the opposite.
Right.
It is admissible, as consent. I didn't see any citing of reason. I didn't find it. I found the authority in other states, but none in this state.
I'm not aware of any that specifically addresses it. The Kyle case does address embarrassing behavior that may or may not fall under the racial statute that the court ruled was that this court ruled was inadmissible pursuant to 403. Mm-hmm. But it's not the flirtatious behavior.
And KN is not about flirtatious or provocative behavior. You cite a case called KN. I'm not sure. I guess it's said in your brief. I'm not sure how you're citing it.
Yeah. I apologize, Your Honor. I don't exactly remember what was included in KN. I don't think I have any notes in front of me either.
Okay, you mentioned a few minutes ago, and I thought that's what you were citing for, but I it's a study in the brief, so I'll look at it.
Yeah, and what I was referring to just a minute ago is the discussion that the Supreme Court has about the purpose and intent of the rape shield statute. I think that that's a fruitful discussion in KN.
Okay. Understand, okay.
To move to the double jeopardy merger issue, here, the fundamental issue is that the victim's awakening provided the fork in the road, to use the language from Wolof and Quintano. And at that point, the defendant made a volitional departure and began a new offense. So what I mean by that is that initially, he was sexually assaulting the victim while she was helpless. She was physically helpless, and he knew she was physically helpless. When she awoke, she began fighting him off, and he used physical force to continue the sexual assault.
Where do we find the evidence of that, that separate evidence exists?
Well, as the trial court ruled, the evidence of her intoxication was evidence which supports the helpless count.
No, I understand that.
And then the evidence of the
second phase or whatever.
Right, of count four, which is the use of force here. It's the evidence that was provided in the audio tape. It's the evidence of her physical injuries. She had bruises and abrasions, bite marks. Her earrings had been ripped from her ears. That is evidence of the use of force. Under the standard of review here, it's not whether there's a possibility that the jury could have relied on the same evidence. It's whether or not it's the trial court abuses discretion in ruling that there was separate evidence to support that count. And here the record does support that. You have the physical injuries in the tape, which recounts that physical, the use of force. You also have the evidence of her intoxication, and the audio tape also supports these two counts. First, that he was sexually assaulting her while she was helpless. She woke up, providing that fork in the road, where the defendant could have stopped, but he didn't. Instead, he continued to sexually assault her, using force to overcome her will.
And that's clear from the tape.
I believe so, Your Honor. And it's also clear from the other physical evidence that was presented at trial. The defendant largely relies on the victim's inconsistent testimony versus her testimony at trial versus the audio tape. As this court is well aware, victims of sexual assault oftentimes become uncooperative later on. But he relies solely on that, ignoring this very important physical evidence that's presented at trial of these physical injuries sustained by the victim.
Do you think it's clear? Was there clear evidence that these physical injuries were incurred in the second part of the assault after she awoke?
Yes, Your Honor. And that audio tape provides an account of him using that force while she tried to fight him off, as he continued that sexual assault.
As opposed to before she awoke,
right,
and when she was helpless. There was no physical injury. She sustained no physical injury during that portion of the assault, the first portion.
I don't recall from the record whether there was evidence that demonstrated there was no physical injury while she was helpless. But the tape does demonstrate that there was that use of force while she tried to fight him off. At that point, you know, essentially she was no longer helpless in the sense that she was when she was unconscious when he began sexual assault. Sorry, Your Honor, I think you had a question.
No, I was Judge Richmond.
Okay.
I think Judge Hawthorne captured my question.
Okay. Well, if there are no more other questions, the people respectfully request that this court affirm the defendant's convictions and sentences. Thank you, Your Honors. Okay, I have very little time left. Volume 11, page 34, defendant asserts that he woke up to KB kissing him. That statement, in support of a consent defense, makes all of the statements of Charmley, Tisher, and Morgan, all of which were excluded, enormously important in support of the consent defense. In addition, I'm out of time. We would ask the
commission to finish your sentence.
Thank you. In addition, if the defendant asserts that the sexual encounter in this case was consensual, and the Tisher, Charmley, and Morgan testimony would have been supportive of that in explaining what we believe is the res gestae behavior from that same night, its exclusion is not just evidentiary error, it's constitutional error because it violates Mr. Schneider's fundamental right to present a defense. Thank you for allowing me to finish my sentence, Judge. I appreciate that. We would ask that Mr. Schneider's convictions and sentence be reversed.
The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.